Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Meet the Author. Denny Griffin here, and for the next 45 minutes, I'll be your host. And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Art Schmidt. Art was born in Brooklyn. During the Vietnam War, he served with Helicopter Attack Squadron 3. He was officer in charge of a Seawolf detachment at Sea Float Solid Anchor on the, I think I'm pronouncing this right, Cao Mau Peninsula in 1970. He served his country as a naval aviator for 22 years, during which time he received a Distinguished Flying Cross, a Bronze Star, 21 Air Medals, 2 Single Action Air Medals, Presidential Unit Citation, Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, and a Vietnamese Air Medal. He flew 808 combat missions, and he received a Ph.D. in 1976. Art, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
There's quite an introduction here, quite an impressive background you have.
Well, I've been through the mill a little.
Listen, why don't let me just give out our phone number in case anyone wants to call in with a question or comment for you.
Okay.
Excuse me, it's 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And if you're listening on my Blog Talk Radio site, you can also text a question through my chat room, Dennis N. Griffin, and I'll relay the question to Art, and he can respond to it that way. Art, do you want to tell us a little bit about your books? You got 2 out and 1 that's going to be out shortly, right?
That's correct. And I actually had 3 tours in Vietnam. And the first book is called A War With No Name, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, A Survivor Story. And I'm actually a psychologist and have licenses in 5 states, but I never did that full time. But having a degree in psychology helped me with some of my post-traumatic stress. And I'll talk about that a little more. But in 1965, I flew off to Yorktown, which is parked a mile from my house. I was flying H-3 helicopters, and I actually crashed one on the deck there. And we were going into North Vietnam doing search and rescue, but there was really no war. We didn't get any medals or any recognition at all. And then in 1967, I was stationed in Guam, and they sent me over flying transports up and down the coast between Saigon and Da Nang. And then in 1969, they said, well, you need to go to Vietnam. And I said, no, I've already been selected for commander, and I've already got 1 air medal. I don't need to go. So anyway, I went and spent my year What happened was they had wanted to send me over to be an officer in charge with an admiral of a slick detachment, which is a helicopter with no guns. So I said, well, I really don't want to do that, but I said, I'll go if you send me to Fort Rucker and get gun training. And they said, no, you got to get over there right now and get with the admiral. So I got over there, and lo and behold, we had some nice brand-new helicopters because the gunships are all old and beat up. But anyway, Admiral Kevin Delaney, Lieutenant JG at the time, was my co-pilot for a lot of those missions. But the Da Nang detachment fell through, and there I was stuck with no gun training. And when the commanding officers went on R&R, I went up to a detachment with Ken Hammond in Det 4 and got gun trained in a week. And as it were, when I came back, the ONC of Det 1 got hurt. And they needed a commander who had gun training, and I barely fit the requirements, so I became the ONC down there in Kamau. And that was a great experience. We were working off of barges with the SEALs. We lived on the barges and flew off the barges. And the VC would come down the river with straw and dynamite on their back and try to blow up the barges. And we had people stationed on each one of the corners of the barges throwing concussion grenades. And that's one of the recurring sounds that I hear now. But anyway, it took me about 10 years of making notes, and then I decided, gee, maybe I have a book here. And so I started writing a book and got into it. And Admiral Kevin Delaney, he was a commanding officer at Jacksonville at one time. Anyway, he wrote the foreword to my book. And in the course of the conversations, he says, well, what kind of medals do you have? And I said, well, I have a Bronze Star, 21 Air Medals. And he said, well, you don't have a Distinguished Flying Cross? I said, no, it always gets downgraded. Well, he got together with a couple of my door gunners, and he and Chief Petty Officer Bill Rutledge got together, and they went through the system and submitted a DFC, and I got it in the mail the day before we invaded Iraq, 32 years after the fact.
Oh my goodness!
And that was thanks to Kevin Admiral, Kevin Delaney, and Bill Rutledge.
Wow.
But then I was on the Yorktown off for a book signing of my first book, and this woman comes by and she says, "Dr. Schmidt, have you considered writing a book about families?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." I said, "This one took 10 years." And she said, "Okay." So she left, and that night I came up with the title, "The Man I Didn't Know: The Stories of Wives and Families Who Have Post-Traumatic Stress." And I mocked up a cover and I wrote the first chapter. And about 3 months later, we had a squadron reunion. And this Marie LeDuc, her husband was a door gunner in HAL 3, and he's on disability also. But anyway, I was standing there talking to this couple, and I said, "You know," I said, "some woman gave me the idea for this book," and I said, "I can't find her," and she says, "It's me, Marie LeDuc." So I got to know her, and I asked her. I said, "Would you write the foreword to the book?" So she says, "I'd love to." Well, after getting to know her for about 3 days. In the reunion, I come to find out she'd been counseling wives and families for years. And so I said to her, "What would you think about," she had incredible resources, and I said, "What would you think about co-authoring the book?" And she says, "It's been my lifelong ambition." So we put the thing together in a year and got some incredible stories. And I mean, you talk about flashbacks and stuff. I mean, boy, I'll tell you, some it's really tough stuff. But in the course of writing the book, she was over at a house from North Carolina, and I said, "You know, I have post-traumatic stress a little." And she says, "Well, you don't have it a little." She says, "You either have it or you don't have it." So I said, "Gee, you know, I haven't been able to watch fireworks for 37 years, and loud noises and telephones drive me crazy, and I have terrible road rage." I said, "Maybe I ought to get into treatment." So I got into treatment in a local psychologist who was a big help with my road rage and so on. But anyway, she was going to move out of town, so she gave me another psychologist, and this guy owned an airplane. And one day I went out there to session, and he said, "I had a cancellation. You want to go fly?" And I said, "Well, gosh, yes, I do." So we go out there, and I have a rule. I count the number of engines and count by two, and if it doesn't come out even, I don't go. But I went anyway with him. And we got airborne and flew over the Yorktown, and I looked down, and I said, "My gosh, I've got 500 landings on that thing, 200 at night," and I crashed on the deck, and I just shook my head. And we got back and landed, and I went home, and I said, "Wait a second, I don't need to do this anymore. I mean, it's over. The flying's out of my system, as much as I love to fly." And then a couple of years ago, I was up in Myrtle Beach, and I called the airport up, and I said, "How much is it to get a ride in a helicopter?" I said, $15 a minute. And I said, "That's $900 an hour." And she said, "Yeah, that's right." And I said, "How come it's so expensive?" She said, "The insurance is real high." I said, "Does that mean that helicopters are dangerous?" She says, "Oh, they're very dangerous." But one funny story about the Yorktown, my main rotors came back and cut my tail off, and the shrapnel, fortunately nobody got hurt except me, but anyway, the shrapnel hit three Marine A4 jets, and the Marines were supposed to go in on a strike in North Vietnam that night, and of course they wouldn't talk to me for a couple of months. But anyway, we had a Yorktown reunion here a couple of years ago, and I was introduced to one of the plane captains that was on the jets there for the Marines, and he has a piece of my rotor blade hanging on his desk on a plaque in his office.
Really?
30-some years later.
Oh, my goodness.
And then when I was flying in HAL 3, one of the dreams I have is we had a flight surgeon. The guy was just unbelievable. He came in the Navy as an enlisted man, worked his way up to chief petty officer, got out, went to medical school, and came back in. And he was our flight surgeon. And this guy flew all the time. And when he left the squadron, he had a Silver Star, Distinguished Flying Cross, and 9 air medals. He's a doctor. I mean, the guy was really a hustler. But anyway, we were out one night doing a medevac and picking up some people, and it was in a monsoon, and the mortars were popping around me, and the mud was on the outside of the airplane, and I couldn't land because it was a rice paddy. But the doctor pulled this person in and was doing a tracheotomy, and the blood was spraying across my instruments, and it was raining like mad, and we managed to get back to that one. And next morning we got up and I went out, and we counted 101 holes in the airplane.
Holy crap.
Yeah. And then the first time I got shot down in the Hilo, I was just taken off, and the modus operandi over there at the VC, they would put a kid in the weeds with a Claymore mine, which is a ground mine. And when I took off, I heard this horrendous crash, or this horrendous boom, and I just kind of made a controlled crash, but didn't do much damage. But either my door gunner, Mike Dobson, or somebody got this kid and killed him. And the SEALs told this lady, he was about 10 years old. And then I've had people ask me, well, how did you get shot down with a ground by that? I said, well, I was only at 30 feet. I wasn't at 2,000 feet. And then the second time I got shot down, we were in a gunfight, and 50 caliber machine gun bullets coming at you look like green basketballs. And I looked down, I saw my gas gauge going down, and fortunately I got hit with a 50 caliber bullet, but if it had been a tracer, it would have been all over. I wouldn't be here. But we got back, I landed the airplane, and we got back, and so that was one of my other experiences there. But one of my tours over in Guam, when I was flying the transports, one 3-week period, we flew 141 hours up in coast, making 10 or 12 landings. And we were getting ready to leave Saigon to go to the Philippines to go back to Guam, and we were all just beat. And I used to fly with a 45 in shorts with a t-shirt and a bandana. And one of the days there was an admiral in the little compartment we had up front for VIP, and I went to go back to the restroom in the back, and the admiral asked my crew chief, he says, "Who's that?" I said, "Oh, he's the plane commander." So, but anyway, we were there 3 weeks the last time. And we didn't have any cargo. We just had fuel to get enough to get to the Philippines. We only had 5 crew members. And I was rolling down the runway at Sansanud or Saigon Airport, and the number one engine started giving out. And I looked at the plane captain, and everybody looked at me, and we didn't know what to do. And I said, "I know what I'm going to do." I sucked it up in the air. I sucked the gear up, and we flew and feathered the engine and flew on 3 engines to the Philippines. Everybody gave me a round of applause because nobody wanted to stay in Saigon.
They were happy to be airborne, huh? Even with only 3 engines.
Yeah. But Kevin Delaney, Admiral Delaney, was our guest speaker at one of our reunions. And, you know, HAL 3 is one of the most highly decorated squadrons ever. And I just want to go through some of the excerpts of this speech, if I may.
Sure.
HAL 3, in the number of years they were in commission, flew 78,000 missions, 131,000 flight hours, 4,000 confirmed kills with another 4,200 listed as possible, 6,400 sampans confirmed destroyed and another 2,300 probable, over 4,000 structures destroyed and over 5,500 damaged. While exact numbers and some statistics may vary slightly, official records show that men of HAL 3 were awarded 5 Navy Crosses, 31 Silver Stars, 2 Legion of Merits, 5 Navy and Marine Corps Medals, 221 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 156 Purple Heart, 101 Bronze Star medals, 142 Gallantry crosses, 16,000 Air medals, 439 Navy Commendation medals, 228 Navy Achievement medals, 6 Presidential Unit Citations, 2 Navy Unit Commendations, 2 Meritorious Unit Commendations, and 1 Vietnam Meritorious Unit Commendation. I mean, that's a heck of a record for a squadron.
Oh, God, I guess it is.
Yeah. So I got into treatment, and I've been a big help, and but I had to, as a psychologist, I said, you know, I'm not watching these fireworks. I can't hack them. So I tried to desensitize myself by watching them on TV without the sound, but I still really can't hack them. At all 4th of July, I go hide. But I met a guy here recently, a couple of years now. His name is Kevin Wethrow, and he's the biomedical engineer of the VA hospital. And he said, "Me, you know," he says, "you ought to go to the VA hospital and try to get, you know, help, a disability. I needed a hearing aid." And I said, "I'm not going near the VA hospital." Well, he finally talked me into it. I went there, and within 5 months, I had a $6,000 hearing aid and 40% disability, combat-related. And it only took 5 months, and you hear some horror stories now how long it takes to get some of that. And, you know, I've been talking to Kathy and other psychologists, and the Iraq and Afghanistan thing is going to be just terrible as far as post-traumatic stress is concerned. It's, you know, there's like 30% coming home now are going in for treatment because of the PTSD. But a lot of times people won't admit they have it if they want to stay in the service, which is not good. But a lot of suicides, a lot of divorce rates, and so on. And then I spoke to Gold Star Mothers one night, and this woman comes up to me and she says, my son is a ranger. He goes over for 3 months to Afghanistan, and then he comes home for 6 months. And she says, what's the chances of him getting post-traumatic stress? And I said, it only takes one incident. And but she just couldn't believe it. I mean, I had to tell her what might happen. And then the president of the Blue Star Mothers came up to me, and she says, well, my son came back from Iraq, and she says, he's failed college, and he can't keep any jobs. You suppose there's a connection? So, I mean, it's really something. But writing the books has been very cathartic and helpful for me.
And your third one, now tell us a little bit about that one, the one that's going to be coming out shortly.
Okay, now that one's kind of interesting. I had the pleasure of training astronauts. They put all of the original astronauts through helicopter training, and I was an instructor in Pensacola. And Harrison H. Schmidt, Jack Schmidt, he was one of the last men on the moon, Apollo 17. And I went down there to see him go to the moon, and he gave me a tour a couple of months before. But anyway, I wrote him, and I said, I'm writing this book about we thought we were invincible. I said, please send me an invincible story. And he writes to me, and he says, the only invincible moment he knows is the day I let him fly, I let him solo the helicopter. But the real story was they had a three-hour hold when I was down there, and he took a nap laying on his back getting ready to go to the moon. I mean, just unbelievable. And then the other astronaut was Owen Garriott, who was on Skylab 3, and I met, you know, most of the original astronauts. But and I've been very fortunate. It took me 22 years in night school to get my 3 degrees, and I was selected in the Navy, one of 2 people to go on a year sabbatical for my master's while I was in San Diego. And I had half my master's done because I'd been going to night school. And so I worked on my PhD, and then I got more shore duty back there to stay, and I finished up my PhD. And so, but I haven't paid a dime. And I listen to these kids now, you know, $48,000, $60,000 college bills. It's just unbelievable. But let's see what else I need to.
When do you figure your next book's going to be out? We thought
just a couple of months, because it's done, it's edited, the cover's done. They just have to put it in their printing galley, and then I have to take one more quick edit on it, and it should be ready to go.
So it won't be long now, then, huh?
No. I mean, just a couple of months it should be.
Okay, good. I was wondering, or let me ask you while I'm thinking about it, when that book
please.
Is out, I'd like to come back on, and once the book's actually available.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and we'll do that with Kathy too, because I think that'll be a good, you know, Kathy Colonel Platoni, she had a tour in Gitmo and a tour in Iraq, and you know, she's got some stories.
Oh, I bet.
And she wrote 3 stories for the book for me. The other thing I had the pleasure of doing is all the presidential pilots, Marine pilots, that were flying helicopters came through when I was instructing, and I trained President Nixon's pilot. And anyway, and now of course they don't fly that particular airplane anyway. But I have a funny story about the new book. I was interviewing some warrant officers, a woman at Hunter Army Base, and this young gal was in her 20s or something, and she's flying Blackhawks, which is a pretty darn big helicopter for this little girl to fly. I sat in the cockpit and I said, this one's over my head, it's got too many instruments and too many radios. But anyway, I said, now write me an invincible story. And she says, there I was over Baghdad, she says, at night, and they were shooting rocket propelled launchers at me, and 50 caliber machine gun shooting at her, and she's seeing the green basketballs. And her comment was, she says, it was just like being in a Star Wars movie.
Really?
you have to think of the mentality, you know.
Yeah.
And, but those UEs that we had, we got them from the Army, and they were so underpowered. It was, I mean, when we would take off on a hot, no-wind day, and many of my door gunners can tell you about that, we had 14 rockets on there. We had a minigun which shot 4,000 rounds a minute, but we never could carry enough ammunition to do any good with it. And anyway, what we would do is you had to get translational lift, get up enough airspeed to get in the air, And sometimes it was a hot, no-wind day. You were struggling, and if this, the low RPM light came on and the beeper came on, the door gunners were instructed to pull the rocket pod, drop all the rockets, 14 rockets, and throw out all the ammunition, and then maybe you can get in the air. And that's happened more than once to a number of people.
Okay.
But and one other funny story about the Seawolves. My door gunners were, all my guys were just great. And my claim to fame is I brought them back all in one piece and alive. And but anyway, there was a Vietnamese VC village, and there was a kiln for firing pottery. And every time we come back, if we had some rockets left, we'd go shoot it at this kiln, and we never could hit it. I mean, we could get down there low, and for some reason or another, the rocket would go away and not do it. So I came home. I was back in the States, and I get this box, and I rattle it, and I know what it was, and I open it up, and in there was a brick from this kiln, and they'd mounted it on a part of an ammo box, and they all my guys signed their name and had a plaque engraved on it, and I have it hanging in my office now.
So you finally got a piece of it, huh?
Yeah, finally got a piece of it. But, we were flying in Agent Orange all the time. I mean, all the foliage around us was gray, and it's a lot of guys are really getting beat up with that. And one of the other things now is they just now have the VA has just now come out and have admitted that in Desert Storm that it might have been that poison gas that they're all getting sick from. See, up until now they were denying that it was the leakage of that. I don't know what kind of poison it is, but the VA just now have said that, yeah, it's from that gas. I can't think of the name of it, but
it took a while, though, didn't it?
Yeah.
Long enough. All right, we got a caller on the line. You got time to take a call?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, hold on. Let me get him on.
Okay.
Hello, caller.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. I can attest to what the commander's talking about. I rode in the right back with him many times, and as he said, when we took off with low power, the gunners would be hanging on to the eject ring on the rocket pod, and we'd have the ammo right there with our knee ready to kick out. We were launching offshore sometimes off LSTs, and the sea float was right on the water. So if we slipped and started sinking into the water, we were done. So what he said about our low power was absolutely true. And if you want to know who it is, Doc, I'm up here in Juneau right now getting ready to go out on another hunt.
I recognize the voice, but I got your email this morning, and you said you were going to be out 9 days looking for bears. But, this is Mike Dobson, one of my superb door gunners who more than once saved my fanny. Why don't you tell them about the honey pots and the sandbags, Mike?
I think you could probably tell that story a little better than I could. Are you going to add the smoke bombs into it?
Yeah, I could, I guess. We had these outdoor latrines there, and we had to put kerosene in some of them, and sometimes we'd throw smoke bombs in, but we had to burn them out. But I would get out there with the guys and do it. And they say, Commando, you don't have to do this. They call me Uncle Art also. And they say, you don't have to do that. And I said, we're making sandbags to build this bunker, and which the rats inhabited very nicely. But anyway, I'm out there, and it was 100-some degrees, and helping fill the sandbags. And they said, Commando, you're the boss. You don't need to do that. I said, I want that bunker done just as fast as you guys. But I always believed in working with the guys. But good old Mike, a couple of years ago, I went up to Alaska to spend 10 days on his boat. He got out of the Navy and got smart and bought a boat and an airplane. And he's a tour guide up in Juneau. And a friend of mine and I went up there and spent 10 days on the boat. And I'm from New York, so I never had never been fishing. And I caught a 48-pound halibut. And my buddy Roy caught a 60-pound halibut. But I'm getting a little old and taking a 48-pound halibut from 175 feet and trying to reel it in, man. I'll tell you, it was tough work. But Mike did a great job. And we're getting ready to go out on the boat. Roy and I pulled out our credit cards, and Mike said, no, this one's on me. And, boy, when I saw the bill, I said, well, gee, Mike, we owe you. But it was a great trip. But and another funny story that I just lost. But and then all the time we're flying over there, I thought these guys were strapped in back there because they'd be hanging out the door all the time shooting. And after when I got up to Alaska, I found out that these guys were not strapped in back there, but they would, when I said going left, they would lean left. And I said going right, they would lean right. And they always knew that I was going to go that way. And they just balanced themselves back there with no restraining. And when I found that out, I said, God, if I'd known that, I would have just flipped out. But
that's true. We never wore the monkey belts. The darn things get all tangled up. We were better off. As long as we trained the pilots to call their turns, everything worked real well.
Well, another thing the door gunners used to do, if they didn't particularly like the way a pilot did things, they would brass them. And you can explain that, Mike.
Well, we had modified those M60 machine guns, which we shot free gun, which meant they weren't mounted, you see, like in Apocalypse Now or whatever. They're mounted to bungees or mounted to poles. Well, we shot free gun, laid them on top of our shoulder, but we'd modify them to where they ejected differently also. And we could control where the brass went just by leaving our elbow down so the brass hit our elbow, or if we saw something we didn't like that the co-pilot that we were using training was doing, we'd just lift our elbow and let him get brass down the neck. They would get smart real quick.
good attention grabber, huh?
Yeah.
You bet. Well, I'll leave you guys go. I'm heading out again in a couple hours, so Doc, good listening to you, and we'll see you soon in the future.
All right. Thanks for calling, Mike. Bye-bye.
You bet.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, Mike was one of the best, I'll tell you. And he had some stories in all of my books. But,
I imagine. I could tell just one little bit we talked here that he would be a great interview and have some great stuff.
Yeah, a couple other things I was trying to think of that I wanted to tell you about, but I did want to get that plug in for VA because I was very suspect about it. But boy, the Charleston VA hospital is absolutely spotless, and I mean, it is really a nice facility. I mean, the guy's waiting. You have to wait for service. But, I mean, 5 months, I got a disability and a hearing aid, which I don't use all the time. But now what I just started doing here about 3 weeks ago is I'm a volunteer tour guide on New Yorktown. And the first day I was on there, I worked for a couple hours. And I'm running up and down the ladders. I'm walking up and down the ladders, and it's about a quarter of a mile from the gift shop to the boat. And boy, when I got home, I couldn't move and get out of bed Sunday morning. My back ached so bad. But now what I do is I take a couple of leaves and put on my back brace and ride the golf cart out to the ship, and then ride the elevator up. But that's been very nice. I had a young couple from Atlanta. They won't let me sell the books on New Yorktown, which is fine. I'm going to figure out some other way to do it. But I just happened to have a book up there with me one day, and this couple came out, and I showed them the book, and they bought it. An hour later, they came back, and they said, we want to get your picture taken with you, get somebody to take the picture. And I thought that was kind of a nice gesture.
Yeah.
And every time that I've been on New Yorktown, at least 10 times a day, people thank me for my service, which is a long way from the way it used to be.
Oh, I was just going to say, thankfully, huh? That's changing. You know, you mentioned the VA, and you're right. It is very refreshing to hear something positive because there are or have been a lot of horror stories about the VA hospitals. So it's nice to hear that they certainly did right by you, and you say it's an immaculate facility, huh?
Yeah, I don't, my 22 years was great. Here's another story. I originally wanted to be an airline pilot. And so I wound up managed to get in multi-engine training, P2Vs, which have two jet engines and two reciprocating engines. So the airlines weren't hiring, so I went down to Pensacola to instruct in T-28s, fixed wing. And by that time, and then I was about 3 months behind getting hired by Delta, but I had 8 years in the Navy, and I said, well, heck, I might as well stay in for 20. There's no sense going with the airlines now, even though that's what I want to do. Well, we had a Yorktown reunion here a couple of years ago, and there was three airline pilots that had retired from the airlines, and one of them, I won't mention the airlines, but his whole retirement check had been cut off, and the other two guys from another airline, 60% of their retirement had been cut off, and I could have been there.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
You made the right move, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't missed a paycheck for many years. So.
But let me ask you a question. Now we were talking about PTSD, and certainly you have the vets coming home from these wars with physical injury, and then you have the PTSD issues. Do you have any statistics of the Vietnam era vets, the number of incidents or reported PTSD cases?
I think in comparing it with, and I think this is correct, it was about 20% of the people coming home would be affected by it.
Mm.
And I was in denial for years. I mean, I didn't know until Marie told me. She said, you don't have it just a little. You either got it or you don't. But Admiral Delaney Kevin invited me down to Jacksonville to speak to the Florida Mental Health Association. And the night before, we had gone to Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. I don't know if you're familiar. You probably have one out in Vegas, don't you?
Yeah.
Very expensive. Oh, we don't have one in Charleston. And there was the Admiral and his wife and my wife and my friend and this couple of women from the Florida Mental Health Association. One of the women came in late, and she says, Dr. Schmidt, she says, I want one of your books. And I said, I got in the car. I'll go get it. So I got it, and I signed it, and I said, now, should I charge her for the book or should I give her the book? I said, oh, heck, I'll just give her the book. The end of the evening, she took out her Pfizer credit card and paid the $1,000 dinner bill.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, my God. All right, hold on. We got another caller. Let me get
you. Oh, okay.
Hi, caller.
Hey, how are you? This is Bud Barnes. That'll strike fear into the heart of your guest there, Uncle Art Schmidt. I just wanted to call and say that despite what the rest of the pilots and the air crew had to say about him, I think he's a pretty good guy. And it is 40 years ago. This October that Art signed my logbook as a student aviator, and that designated me as a naval aviator, and on we went with our lives, and Art and I wound up in the same squadron in Vietnam, and he's quite a guy.
Hmm. Well, thanks, and I can't believe it was just yesterday, 40 years ago, huh?
Yeah, I know. Time flies when we're having this much fun.
Bud, you have to tell Denny what your email address is.
Oh, okay. Oh, the Bud Man.
Yeah, the Bud Man.
Three Bud Man.
Yeah, that's it.
I like it.
Yeah, but anyway, it's been a lot of fun. We've been able to cross paths from time to time in the last 4 decades, and life is good. It's got some interesting things that happened to all of us, but I guess we're made it through and have had some great times together and a lot of friendships.
Yeah, that's for sure. I wouldn't go to the reunions for years, and because I just didn't want to expose myself to it. And once I finally went, I hope I live long enough to go to 100 of them. But,
yeah.
Something
I think that as people that aren't necessarily familiar with the Vietnam era is that as a result of the adverse press and all that went on. A lot of the guys that got out of the service kind of went back to little holes in the wall, not totally, but I mean not in a mainstream that many of us that stayed in and made a career of that and kind of reinforced each other more than anything else just through our friendships and whatever, that now a lot of these guys are coming back into the fold where a lot of the myths are being dispelled, and there's just a much better look at history for what it really was, instead of how it was so trumped up by the press.
Yeah.
Can I take advantage of having both of you on here now, and just ask, because obviously with the presidential elections coming up, Iraq and Afghanistan have been kind of hot items. Do you fellas see any similarities in the coverage, the press coverage of the current battles or current wars, as you did with Vietnam? Do you think there's any comparison there?
Well, I'll tell you this: if I had a newspaper guy in my helicopter, I would have thrown him out.
Okay. I think that at the time it was happening to us, we didn't quite recognize it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Whereas today we can look back and say, wait a minute, we're not going to let happen to what happened to us that we sort of found out after the fact. At least we saw the fallout. We're not going to allow that to happen to the brave young men and women that are, you know, headed in and out of Southwest Asia these days. So much has to do, I think, as far as acceptance of, you know, warlike activities, is really understanding the reasons behind why we do something. And I always try to look at it in a security standpoint of the fact that you don't want a cancer to grow to the point that it could be terminal for you. You want to get on issues early on. And those that take the initiative to do that are people that that we really should stand up and praise. And that's where our young troops are. The other thing, too, in this warfare today, we don't see it as much, but if you really want to go out and rub elbows with the troops, you need to go to some of these hospitals where they're convalescing and the rest of it, because we're saving a lot of lives today, but we're also losing a lot of limbs, severe injuries that in previous wars they would have died. Vietnam, we had a pretty good recovery rate, but Korea, World War II, we lost a lot of folks that because of severe injuries. But that's where see these sacrifices.
Yeah, and that was because of the helicopter mainly.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Fellas, we got another call. Why don't you stay on the line, both of you, and maybe you'll know the next caller. Let me go ahead and get hooked up here. 559 area code, you're on the line.
Good morning, Mike Worthington from California.
Morning,
Mike. Hi,
Mike.
How you guys doing this morning?
We're doing great. We're just waiting to get to the reunion.
I hear that one. That'll be coming up in August in Nashville.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little bit about the Seawolves. I tell you what, it probably one of the things that probably spoiled a lot of naval careers. We were such a close-knit organization, and the old adage, we did so much with so little, we can do anything with nothing at all, is, very much in what we did in Vietnam. And but just to have known and flown with these guys and over all the years, almost, getting on to 35 to 40 years now, is just been one of the greatest things that ever happened in my life. And and once the association got back together, just knowing that you can call any of the brothers anytime and talk and about anything, and it's just remarkable. And but I caught the one deal about talking about taking journalists up in the helicopters. I personally hated it. I didn't like PSYOPs, so we went out with speakers, and they played all this stuff, and then Vietnamese, and kicked the speakers out one day because I'd never taken so much fire in all my life, and thought threw the intel guy out with it, and he was yelling at me not to return fire. But when I'm getting shot at, I'm going to return fire. That's just the way it is. But anyhow, come to find out, we had to take this guy up for a little ride in a helicopter, and I was groaning and, talking under my breath until I looked up and I saw him coming and noticed he had no flight helmet, he had no air plugs, and he had no sound attenuators. I tell you what, I couldn't wait to get this guy up in the air. So we got out into an area that's a free fire zone, which meant that we could, anything that was there was open game. And so as soon as we got him out there, and we were flying a door-mounted minigun at Det 4 at Ben Luck, and as soon as we were cleared, I could not wait to fire that minigun, because I put the left finger on and the right finger, called the judge and the executioner. The judge rotated the barrel, and the executioner ignited the rounds off. And I looked back, and this guy's eyes were about 4 feet wide. His mouth was hitting the bottom of the helicopter, and I was just laughing. I think that was probably one of the most pleasurable rides I had in a helicopter, it's just a shame the way that a lot of things are portrayed about the servicemen and the great work that we do under the conditions we do it in. And
We never heard of what this navigation stuff they got now, you know. And the way we navigated at night was we waited till the lightning struck so we could see where we were going. And we knew that we had to stay just high enough to stay above the trees. But it was always raining, always monsoons. And my first day on deck as the ONC, there was eight people on a sandpan. And I'm from New York. If somebody starts shooting at me, I shoot back. And these Vietnamese VCs in the sandpan start shooting. I mean, I rolled in and shot them, and four of them fell into the brackish brown lake, and the lake turned red. And I see that scene all the time. I don't have any guilt about it, but I just see it, flashback all the time. And but another funny story. You guys can identify this. The first reunion I went to, the guys were there, the door gunners and Mike and Tom Clavin and so on. And I said, "How come you guys look so young?" And I said, "Well, remember, we were 18 and you were 35. And one other thing I remember is that they used to put formaldehyde in the beer to preserve it. And you'd wake up the next morning and you'd think you'd been drinking for 3 days when really all you had was about two beers, but the formaldehyde would just knock you wild.
Did you want a hams or a hot hams or a hot Ole, huh?
Yeah, right. And then John McCain's father came down when he was running Southeast Asia, and my guy said, "Well, let's go to the Australians and borrow some steak and lobster." And I said, "No, hell, let's just give them lip rats like we eat, where you put water and it makes spaghetti, you know, let them see what it is." He gets plenty of steak and lobster back in Saigon. But he was very nice and, you know, just a neat guy. And I always have respected John McCain for what he did with the POW. And if I ever get my hands on Jane Fonda.
You'd probably have to stand in line because, you know, I would love to put her and a few of the other ones right in the right on the ground and draw the ring of fire around them and say, "Okay, the next call's yours, you know. You want to venture forth or you want to have a change of heart, you know." But talking about the lerp rats, I think at times that Vietnam came along so we could clear out the government stores of ammunition and sea rations, because we were eating sea rations and shooting ammunition from the 41-42 era.
Yeah, exactly.
And no,
that's actually true. There were a lot of these old sea rations that were marked in the late 40s and early 50s that were in storage somewhere. And, case of these things, and I mean, it'd been around that long. That's what you were fed from time to time.
Bill Rutledge sold some on eBay that I had. The spaghetti finally gave up because the top of the can started rounding off. But the fruit cocktail, and the crackers and peanut butter and jelly was still good, as far as I know. Somebody bought it and paid a bunch of money for it.
Don't give me any more flashbacks.
something I think that it may not be within the grasp of the listening audience per se, but what was kind of unique about this squadron is it had a whole lot of detachments, and those were two helicopters that were sort of on call primarily. It would do everything from reconnaissance to response, and it was like having your own little Air Force. So you had your operating area, and you knew your guys that you worked with on the ground, the boat guys, everything, and that was what was neat about it. For the enlisted men, this was about as far out as you could get. I mean, they were right at the true tip of the spear. And for the pilots, it was kind of neat because it was like, well, figure out how to get in and get out. You didn't have somebody watching over you. And it was very neat from that individual operational opportunity that it has never been that way since for any of us.
Yeah, well, at that time I had those eight people shooting at me, it was not in a free fire zone. And I don't know who's flying the wingman, but I said, "We're rolling in." I said, "Change frequencies." And I didn't ask anybody's permission. Somebody shoot at me, I shoot back.
Well, anyway, I'm going to get off the phone, gentlemen, but good talking with everyone.
Well, thanks for calling, bud.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.
Anyhow, just one last thing. I first started flying Sea Lords over there, and I flew down to Det 1, down to Nam Can, solid anchor, darn near it seemed like every day, and stood in amazement of the gunners and the pilots down there, and they showed me and helped me, you know, to become a good Det gunner when I finally decided to go out to Det. But I would fly down in, from our home base at Ventura down to Det 1 every day, and anything those guys needed down there, if they needed parts, they needed,
radio.
You know, that's what I did for them. But anyhow, guys, hey, you have a great day, and Uncle Art, we'll see you at the reunion.
All right, sir. Denny, let me give a little book info, if I may, here.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for calling, Mike. Okay, go ahead, Art.
They can go to Amazon.com and get either one of those books. My new book will be with Arthur Howson. Now, when I get on again, I'll talk about that. But all you have to do, another way of doing it, is go to Google and go to Dr. Art Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, and that information will come up to both books, and you can order them. Or they can send me an email at doc, that's Delta Oscar Charlie, doc, BTB, Bravo, team, Bravo Tango Bravo, that's my company, Business Team Builders, at bellsouth.net. If they send me an email, tell me what they want, I can autograph a copy, and they can send me a check and so on if they want to do it that way.
Just for your information, we exceeded our time. We were cut off the live broadcast, but what the information you just gave out will be on the archive show, so we didn't lose it. Anybody who listens in the future will get the full thing,
good,
the full program.
Okay.
Listen, Art, I want to thank you so much for being on today and also the folks who called in. And we'll do it again when your new book comes out.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I thank Ralph Christopher profusely for hooking me up with you. And once again, I thank you for what you're doing for my daughter. And we'll just be in touch.
Okay, Art, thanks a million. Have a great day.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, another very interesting, entertaining program, and thanks everyone for joining me, and until next time, have a great day. Bye-bye.